We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hey guys, it's Alan Garfinkel, your Rock Art Podcast, and we've got another episode for you on the way. Bernie Taylor, naturalist and author, who's a researcher and someone who is going to trace the development of religious thought, mythology, biology, and prehistory and rock art all in 1 hour's time. Come along for the ride. Welcome out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we are absolutely blessed and honored to have a world-class academician. His name is Bernie Taylor. He's a naturalist and author. And his research certainly explores or does a deep dive into the mythological connections and also the biological knowledge among Native people and the ancient people. He has worked on a variety of books and articles, including Biological Time, Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. And what he does is explore the deep roots, really the basal capacity of mankind, by looking at how hunter-gatherers viewed themselves within the natural and spiritual world, moving from the Paleolithic cave art about 40,000 years ago. Taylor has proposed that selected cave paintings are in fact fundamental pieces of the human journey of self-realization. And I would certainly echo that assertion. That they're the foundation of a written language and a record of the biological knowledge that basically affected us so deeply through their artistic styles, their religious patterns, and the stories that are still ingrained in our neurotheology. Bernie's also been widely interviewed on podcasts and speaks at popular conferences and academic symposiums across the fruited plain. And he's joining us today for our hour-long journey to explore some of these topics. Bernie, are you with us?
I'm with us today, Alan, and thank you for having me on the show. We are indeed going to take a deep dive. We're going to go deep into the human imagination tens of thousands of years ago. So we're going before North American rock art. We're going before Beringian migration. We're going to places that prior to a few years ago, nobody could have ever imagined could have been seen this perspective.
That's fabulous, Bernie. I'm really open and interested in developing more on those particular topics. In this initial segment, one of the things we always try to do is contextualize the contributor, our guest scholar. Maybe you could give us just a thumbnail of how you ever got involved in this particular specialization and research domain.
Well, I started this from the chronobiology side. I was interested in how plants and animals time themselves. So geese, for example, migrate earlier later from one year to the next. But the geese can't follow one smart goose. So there has to be an actual mechanism to do this. And I studied the question in conjunction with Oregon Fish and Wildlife biologists, but we did it for salmon. And we looked at the migration timing of salmon early, later, one year, the next, which had no relevance to, how should I say, the flow of the water or anything else we could find. And so we looked at it from the perspective of light, dark signals. And lo and behold, we found that during the dark nights, the salmon migrated. And during the light nights, they stopped. So the salmon are timed not just by the light of the day, but they're also timed by the night. And it was sort of, they weren't looking from that perspective when I entered the scene. And so their data was basically unblemished. It wasn't, you know postured in this direction. And so they currently use this hypothesis in how to time the behavior of salmon and other animals. So it became sort of a procedural thing. And then there was a problem, though. There was a problem in the math. And so I could tell you that, you know, every new moon, every full moon, you could find a bunch of, actually full moon within the year, you can find a whole bunch of salmon spawning in this area because they spawned around the full moon when they stopped and they were together. But I couldn't tell you which full moon it was. I couldn't tell if it was a fourth or fifth, hypothetically, full moon from any point in the year. And so I said to myself, well, someone had to know this, because how did people survive in the ancient prehistoric times? So I looked in ancient books, I looked at calendars, lunar calendars. And then I went to the tribes, because the tribes in the Columbia Basin have a rich history of lunar calendars. And I didn't find the answer, but they kept telling me a story. They kept telling me a story about the coyote and how the coyote intermixes with the swallows. And they then following the in-migration of the swallows, they would start seeing the salmon. Well, that didn't make any sense to me. And so I sort of moved on. And then someone said to me, well, maybe you should look at upper paleolithic cave art since you have this tradition in North American Indians, at least in the Pacific Northwest. And so I started seeing the same nomenclature of the timing with animals in upper paleolithic cave art, as was biological among these animals and in the tradition of Pacific Northwest Native Americans. Still never figured out, or understood, how do you know which full moon it will be in the time of the year? And then, so I put this on the side because I did know the answer. And I came back 17 years later and I started looking at it again from a different perspective. And I re-thought about what Native Americans were telling me. And then I got it. And I recognized that you actually can't tell whether it's four or five lunations from the winter solstice or any solar point. You go off an indicator species. An indicator species for the Columbia Basin salmon was the swallows. And so I took that idea and I went back to upper paleolithic cave art, which had been then dated to more than 30,000 years ago. And I expanded in different directions. So that's how I stepped into this. I was not interested in upper paleolithic cave art. I was really not interested in Native Americans. I mean, I am emotionally interested in Native Americans, but I was not interested in their culture at the time. I was interested in knowing how the heck can I tell which lunation the salmon would be coming upriver, which sent me off in a direction I never could have imagined, and which is, as in your word, blessed in the what has transpired.
So it appears that it's the habits and habitats of certain key animals that are what I've called them indexical animals or semiotic animals that are principally important for some of the information that they share. Is this correct?
That would be absolutely correct. So the Tualatin tribe, which is near to Seattle and Washington, their indicator species was the white pine butterfly. And so at a certain point in the year, the scouts would go looking for the white pine butterfly. And then they would say that the next highest of the high tides around the new full moons, when they're literally, they could get their canoes, big canoes out up by the longhouse into the surf, they would go to find the first salmon. So the first, the indicator species was the white pine butterfly. And I've actually gone around, this entire Pacific Northwest through the anthropological literature, as well as into the, Pacific North, as I say, the Siberian, Greater Siberia, Kamchatka, and they found all these indicator species. So it's purposeful, it's known, and it predates Beringia migrations because it's on
Makes
both
sense.
Sides.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Both sides. So we can date this to, so we can say that, you know, archaeologically, people came down at least 15,000 years ago. You can argue to 19. I have no issue with that. But people in Beringia, 22,000 years ago. So now what we have here is we have a time frame that is consistent with, let's call it the later part of Upper Paleocavart. So let's go with 17,000 years ago. El Castillo, Altamira, Chauvet are in the 30s of thousands of years ago. So it is theoretically possible, and I've demonstrated, that the time is, for 20,000 years, one could think that an idea can travel from the Iberian Peninsula across through Siberia, then hang in Beringia for a few years, and then come down to North Americans. So it all works together. And that leads us to, you know, the big, you know, really big question that we've talked about is, who are these people? I mean, really, who they are and how do we define them? And the two key words that we use are animism and shamanism.
Yes. So why don't we do a bit of a soundbite on what animism and shamanism are and how they might be differentiated from one another?
Absolutely. So this was going to take just a few minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Animism is the concept that everything has a spirit. So when an animist hears the wind, he or she is listening to the voice of the cosmos. When the animist climbs a mountain, a tall mountain, then animist is connecting to the great beyond, the great mystery by so many words, connecting to the cosmic order. When an animist crosses a river and interacts with a river, the animist is being reborn in a sense. When an animist talks to rocks, animist believes that all the animals are not other animals, but rather brothers and sisters among animal beings. And of course, you've read and heard many of the Native American stories, mythological stories of people interacting with animals. And you've heard them in other countries or the nations as well. So that's what an animist is. And the word before animism was primitive man. That's what we use. The word animism comes around the late 1800s. Now, shamanism is kind of the big word out there. Shamanism comes out of Siberia about 1900. And what had happened is Russian ethnographers and anthropologists traveled into what we call Siberia. And they encountered a phenomenon that they couldn't explain. Or it wasn't actually, sometimes it was explained to them. Sometimes it was explained to them, they didn't understand. And sometimes they just really didn't want to know. And they walked away from this tradition of so-called shamanism as saying these people are fundamentally insane. And you have to be an insane person to become a shaman. Well, that work was put into a format, an anthropological format that was republished by the American Museum of Natural History. And ethnographers then traveled around the Arctic. They traveled into the western part of North America and ultimately into the plains. And they used this same format of the text that you would have, you know, one section talked about hunting implements, another fishing, another talked about basket weaving. Another section talked about religion or calendars. And then another section, which sort of like the heap, where what we didn't understand, didn't want to understand, and thought was fundamentally crazy, went into the box of shamanism. Okay. And so shamanism became what we could describe as an academic device versus an actual phenomenon. Because the so-called shaman that they're describing in the Great Plains were very different than the shaman of Siberia, where the word originates from. Enter 1950s. Marseille Eliade writes a number of works. And put Eliade into context, he's a religious historian originally from Hungary, and he was in the same camp as Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell. And so we have the ideas between those three and others that were traveling in Europe and teaching. They are synchronous, and most of them published are the Bollinger, supported by Bollinger. So we have Eliade writes a book called Shamanism, and the subtitle of the book is Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. What Eliade does is he doesn't look at it from shamanism anthropological perspective and put it, this is everything we don't know, don't want to understand, and we think is fundamentally crazy. But what Eliade does is he looks at common elements among people primitive man by probably another word from it, around the world, and he looks for the concepts of, for example, the cosmic mountain that the hero or the spiritual leader climbs. He looks for the waters of transformation. He looks for commonalities of people dressing up as birds or angels by another word, and how they use that as a transcendent device to another realm. That's what shamanism under Eliade was about. But what happened is that, you know, 30, 40 years later, we have anthropologists enter the scene. And anthropologists and archaeologists do not like the idea of the cosmic mountain. They do not like the idea of the water transformation. They do not like, a common element of bird people for a very good reason. And it's an important reason. It's because it asks the question of diffusion. Did this happen, hyperdiffusion, in the last hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of years? Or actually tens of thousands would be hyperdiffusion. But when did this all happen? And that creates a serious question within archaeology, because how do you find, you know, make a tree of all these elements? And so the shamanism was sort of reinvented in South Africa by Daniel David Lewis, and in conjunction with Jean Clot, an absolute titan in archaeology, as you know, and you probably know him. They went down this path of Upper Paleolithic cave art had a root in shamanism. Okay. And there are, in fact, animistic elements, you know, that's in their work. And they fully know the difference between animism and shamanism, but they follow the academic device of the word of shamanism. And so when people, and here's a question for you, Alan, when people think of shamanism, what are the one or two words that they think of? So the common man as well as the academic.
I think they think of altered states of consciousness, ASCs.
What is the most common practice when people think of shamanism?
Dancing, singing, death, okay. Rebirth, trance, all the above.
What's another one? There's one more.
Flight to the heavens.
And the big
heavens.
One is actually flight, also hallucinogenic substances. Okay.
Altered states of consciousness, the use of various ethnobotanicals. Yeah.
Ethnobotanical substance, exactly. And so there was pushback in anthropological and archaeological communities, in the greater community, against what Jean Clot and Daniel David Lewis were saying. It's because people won't be looking at the first five things that you discuss, but rather people will be tying in the last one, the substances. And that's what happened. And that's what happened around the world. Because people, dancing, chanting is not as sexy as the substances. And so through this academic device, there became a split in archaeology anthropology with what Daniel David Lewis and Jean Clot were proposing. And if you should probably have John, you can get Jean Clot program. He's very accessible. And sure. He'll tell you it's shamanism. And he's written many papers, and there's a book in front of me that he co-authored with Lewis Williams. But he can't actually define what the shamanism is in the cave art, except for a few, you know, Les Trois Frères. You have the man dressed up with the antler head. But there's really few instances that it can do that. And what the two of them lacked at the time in Upper Paleolithic cave art is they lacked images of mountains, rivers, people dressed up as birds or connecting with birds into the great beyond. They lacked constellations or cosmology.
Let's cut it off right there. Just as we're getting into the meat of the matter, and I'd like to sort of put a bow on it there, and then catch it and move it through in the second segment. So I'll meet y'all on the flip flop, and I'm absolutely entranced by this story.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code ROCKART. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Well, welcome back. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And we're talking to Bernard Taylor, Bernie, a naturalist and a remarkable aficionado of all things cosmic realm, from archaeoastronomy and sacred narrative, and understanding the works of shamanism, animism, totemism, and the evolution of our religious thought. We were just getting into, in the last segment, sort of some of the deeper proclivities and theoretical constructs that have been espoused by some of the most influential theoreticians, anthropologists, archaeologists, and others about these very matters. So let's just jump back and turn it over to Bernie again, and he can continue this discussion. So Bernie, where were we when we were so rudely interrupted?
We're at the point that there was an absence of images of cosmology, so stars, constellations, mountains, rivers, and let's say birdman, angel type of characters, people dressed up with feathers. Well, I was watching about 7 or 8 years ago, Cosmos came back with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And you probably saw that I think they've had two since then. Mm-hmm. And about like 5-10 minutes in the program, they have these so-called primitive man around a campfire, animals running across the field, animals fly up in the sky, and they somehow become constellations or something like that. And I look at that and I said, wow, that's what I was trying to figure out. So I contacted the producer of the program, which was not Neil deGrasse Tyson. Oh, he's a brilliant astronomer and actor. Mm-hmm. I contacted the person who actually wrote the program, who was like the thesis advisor to Carl Sagan, who was on the original program. And I asked him, I sent him my work, and I said, where did you get that from? And he said, we made it up. We made it up. Okay. And so like the aha moment. So I said, well, maybe somebody else has made this up. And I did an internet search, and I came up to the work of Chantal, who's in France. And I believe she has a doctorate in astronomy. And Chantal is probably in her late 70s, early 80s right now, only speaks French. And we've become, you know, friends through the translators of Google. Well, Chantal had actually did that work that was probably in the back of the producer's head or writer's head when that was done at the Lascaux Cave. And you can go online, you can see images of Chantal's work. It has like the stars against in the hole of bulls against a big bull and some other animals as well. And Jean-Claude, go back to Jean-Claude, absolute titan, has a voice in archaeology, which is very important. Mm-hmm. He said on this documentary that you can throw enough stars at any paleolithic wall, and you're going to finally match with the constellation. And he was right. He was right about that. And so you can flip a coin one way or the other about Chantal's work, because she's actually moved into other directions. She moved into the biological work that I was from my work with the lunar mm-hmm. calendars. I was really not that much of a constellation sort of person. I was into lunar calendars. So I went back mm-hmm. and started looking at this cave art. And I looked at El Castillo Cave. And I was looking at the panel, the red discs, which has about 80 red discs about the size of the palm of your hand going across. And I'm counting the red discs just like I was doing before. I was mathematically minded. I was, you know, as Dr. Edwin Krupp describes me, that I'm a quantitative naturalist. And he also said I wrote the most unusual book he's ever read. I consider Dr. Krupp not to be just a titan archaeoastronomy, but a national treasure. And you could let him know the next time you can connect sure. with him. So
I'll connect it.
So I'm looking at this panel red disc. It's about 10 meters across, 5 meters high. And, you know, I'm counting the red disc, and I'm just not making a count that makes any sense to lunar. And so again, like kind of looking back on my fuzzy eyes, and I say, boy, that looks like an elephant. And an elephant with his ears up and his trunk out. And I said, wow, that really, I mean, I'm actually, and I showed other people, said, yeah, that looks like an elephant too. And next, above the elephant, there's something looking like a lion. And something unusual about this lion was it has a mane. And Upper Paleolithic cave lions in Europe did not have manes. So I reached out to someone from my distant past. I lived in Beijing, China during my early 20s. I'm 56 now, so you can kind of put that into perspective. And during that time period, I encountered another titan. His name is George Schaller. And George Schaller was the mentor of Jane Goodall and everybody you could possibly imagine during that time period. And he's still living. He's late 80s. I reached out to George via the internet. He didn't remember me, of course. And of course, I remembered him because he was actually on the cover, the inside cover of National Geographic that time. And I said, George, can you help me with this question? Is this an African lion, a European lion? And is that an elephant? And if it's an elephant, is it a European elephant, which were prevalent at the time, or is it an African elephant? So George and I, we went back and forth for a few emails. And then I started coming up with more animals and more and more and more. And finally, when we got to the draft, George is like, yeah, this is Africa. So we designated that one side of the panel, the viewers left, was Africa. The viewers right was Europe with all these European animals like the horse. And in the center of the panel, we have these marine animals. We have a dolphin. We have a whale. We have crabs. We have a few others, a monk seal. So we have this panel that all these embedded images, and it's quite fascinating. And I'm asking George about questions about chronobiology, because that's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in landscapes. I'm not interested in the ocean, the seas, or whatever. I'm interested in chronobiology. How do I know what time of year this was? So we went back and forth, and we basically designated some of the animals, the time of year, and so forth. And one was the lynx, and George was very clever about. When George came, every time he gave me an answer back, it wasn't about the chronobiology. It was about the relationship between the artist and the animals and what he recognized.
Okay.
So George would say that it's a beautiful scene between the mother and the juvenile in which she licks him or licks her or what, it was something like that. So George is coming back to me like a poet. And this is a person that spent many, many years in the savannah, and he wrote the pivotal books in early naturalism. And so I learned a lot from George, and I hope I brought some, life to him as well. And it's quite interesting because he was still traveling. He works with the Panthera, big cat people, and he travels around the world. And so we, I would be we'd be going back and forth, and then he'd disappear for 2 months. And then those 2 months, I'd come up with a whole bunch more animals. So we established this fundamental zoo, and different, just like we have a zoo here in Portland, they have different animals at different parts of the park. Still, I'm trying to figure out the chronobiology, and I have absolutely no interest in constellations, which, kind of brought me back into this thing. And so then I've got these animals, and I'm starting to say, well, this bear is interesting because the bear, it has two juveniles, and it looks like the juveniles are climbing the tree, which mother bears do to teach them how to climb to safety. And I was looking at, and this is no relationship between the two. I was looking at pictures of the pyramids, okay, just like they're on the wall, this, poster sort of thing. And what the pyramids was showing me is a geometry that I hadn't thought about. And it was I looked at the geometry of the bears, and as I said, there's no relationship between the bears and the geometry of the pyramids. But I started thinking about the geometry of the bears, and I realized, oh my God, that looks like Ursa Major, the geometry in these bears. And then I said, well, this man here then must be Orion, and this man up here would be Hercules. And then I realized the horse was then become Pegasus. And I went around this whole thing, and I recreated the night sky. At that point, it was about 8 constellations. Now I'm about 16. And these aren't constellations that I'm sort of making in my head. These are the same constellations, the same animal characters, in the same order as the ancient Greeks had in their record. But the Mesopotamians didn't. So it begged the question, how did the ancient Greeks know this? But how did the Greeks know it, but the Mesopotamians didn't? Because the Mesopotamians was supposed to be an early source. And I gave a presentation on this subject last week in Bulgaria, and of course, it was remotely, to the European Society of Astronomy and Culture. And I list this whole thing out. People go to my webpage, they can actually see the presentation with all spelled the whole thing out, beforeorion.com. It's there. And so the presentation asked the question, how do different people have different information but one group has a lot of information. And so we can go back into the caves and we could actually see a lot of tourist trash. The Phoenicians had been there. The Egyptians had been there. And I mean, not the Egyptians, but the Greeks had been there. And because they left amulets in these caves. They left, you know, their weapons. They left all kinds of stuff, fundamentally tourist trash that you would find maybe in Disney World. Because this was mm-hmm. their Disney World. And there are many caves that have these images. And so what happened was people were going back to these caves. And when they went back to these caves, they found archetypal characters in a Jungian sense. So the man, Orion, for example, could be, he's in one image, you could see him as slaying the lion. Another one, you can see him as taking care of the lion, different perspectives, or playing with the lion. However, whatever mindset you bring into it, whether you're fighting with lions, killing lions, or playing with lions, that's what you walk out with. Okay. And so in the Greek world, they had a very definite perspective. And theirs was that Orion went around slaying animals wherever he went. But the ancient Greeks also mm-hmm. had this concept of centaurs, and centaurs taught all of the great heroes, okay? Every one mm-hmm. of them. And it's actually the centaur, Chiron. So we can actually find Chiron in multiple caves because he is as a man that overlaps with a horse to become the centaur. Now, in the Paleolithic mind, which now takes us back to animism, where we started, the Paleolithic mind is that man and so-called other animals are brothers and sisters. We learn from these animals in the same way George was explaining it to me, but we also take on the strengths of animals. So perhaps you're smart as an owl, or as fast as a cheetah, or we're strong as an ox. Words that we still use in our vernacular, which suggests we still have this animistic mind within us. And so we have all these images, we have these concepts, and they carry to us today around the world, which asks the question of diffusion and how this all happened. Well, obviously, mm-hmm. people didn't travel across, you know, hundreds or just, you know, 2,000 years ago, travel across the oceans on, you know, fantasy continents. You've heard all the stories. It didn't happen. But rather, across from Beringia 20-something thousand years ago, people had traveled into North America, and they carried some of this knowledge with them. And Ursa Major, as the she-bear, is found across North America, okay, mm-hmm. as the constellation. We all find Cirrus as a dog or a wolf, but a canine for sure, in North America. And we mm-hmm. find these constellations all around the world. We don't find
correct
constellations that the animals that we no longer find, that we had in the Paleolithic, that we lost as we traveled around the world, that were no longer with us. It talks about diffusion of more than 20,000 years ago, which I believe in anthropological archaeology circles should be acceptable, because we can show that Adelaide moved around, you know, was it how many years, 2,000 years, 2,000 years ago, the bow and arrow was 600 years ago, I don't know, but we can, or six, actually 500 BC or so. If we can show that implements of hunting traveled around, why can't we say that constellations, and why can't we say that myths? Because these myths are within us. They're archetypes that we carry. That, you know, we have the mother bear who protects her young, which of course is the mother bear, the den mom. It's the protective mother bear that we have in our own worlds. But we also have the hero, we have the apprentice, we have the mother, we have the child, we have the wise man, the shaman, we have the hero, the villain, and so forth. So within our psychology, we carry these concepts. When we see the image, the archetype is projected, and the story is found. But it all depends on what we take with us. Is the wise old man, you know, the villain, or the person who's manipulating the young child, or is the wise old man who's actually teaching the young child? So we take our own baggage with us, and people did that around the world. And they looked at these cave arts, and they took it with them, and we have all these rich stories with some common elements among them. And that's what Eliade was looking for. Eliade was looking for the cosmic mountain. He was looking for the river transformation. He was looking for the world tree. And these are the things, some of them, I should say, that we can now positively identify in this upper Paleolithic cave art to at least 34,000 years ago, because we can identify mountains in these panels. We can identify bodies of water that people cross, because we actually have a swimmer. We can identify constellations and a cosmic order, whereas people look to the night skies not just as another place, but a place that reflected their own world and that they could, in fact, ascend to. Or the underworld, the caves that they could descend to. There are three planes that interact with each other. And that's the so-called animus mind that we formally call the primitive mind and perhaps called the heathen mind in some circles as well. So that's a long journey.
Very much so. And I think it's a perfect place to cut off and move into the next segment. That's quite a travel and quite a distance, but I think we're on the right track, gang. See you in the flip-flop.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel with your Rock Art Podcast. We are blessed and tremendously honored to have Bernie Taylor, who's quite a remarkable individual who's going giving us the journey from the inception of cave art and sort of the development of religion and talking about the cosmos and the integration of the sky world and the animal world and the nature of sort of the cognitive vision, the cognitive template of indigenous people. So with that, I'll segue back to our colleague, Bernie Taylor. Keep going, Bernie. It's yours.
Well, thank you, Alan. And we're going to take it close to home now. Close to home, that is in our Western tradition, our Abrahamic tradition, and people who, you know, Christians, whether they be Methodists or Catholics, there's a concept of the angel. And the angel is the, in Abrahamic tradition, is the messenger between the human, or us, and the divine, meaning the God or the great Almighty. We find this fundamental tradition in the ancient world. We find it among the ancient Mesopotamians, who Ishtar transfers between the two. They have a shamanic character who they call the, I don't want to, shamanic, I shouldn't use that word. They have a genie character who has wings and also is the intermediary between the two. It's Horus among the ancient Greeks. And if we travel around the world, doesn't matter where you go, you will find wherever there are hunter-gatherer or indigenous peoples, you will find at the very least that someone puts a feather in their hair or on their clothes to reach to the great beyond, the travel to the great mystery. And we find this, among shamanic people in Siberia as well. So we have this tradition, and you had a guest on a few weeks ago when you talked about the eagle feather as being the eagle being the highest flying bird that takes one into the cosmos per se. I have a Native American friend who has no connection to your friend, and my Native American friend, he is the spiritual leader for the region, as part of this Columbia Basin region, and he can take his tradition back hundreds of years. He can travel through every person, every name throughout time. So he predates, you know, contact of Europeans, or his tradition does. And he told me that same story. He explained it in the same way. He explained many other things to me. And he says that Native Americans will, in this part of the world, and I can't say where specifically, but they have cages on mountains where the bird will roost, or actually the will just be in the nest, and they will grab, someone will climb up on the mountain or the cliff and pull an eagle's feather from them. And that helps them to then in ceremony reach the great beyond. Well, in uphill at the cave art, we can actually find this same birdman character. Now, the birds change based on the geographical location of the panel and what they're depicting, but we still have it. In the El Castillo cave, we have the man who has a juvenile eagle on his shoulder, which, well, it's about a foot tall, tells us it's a mid to late June time period. And then if you shift it 90 degrees, the man has a mask, and the eagle's head becomes a beak on the mask of the man. So he transforms into this bird man. And on this panel, we find the same, another character who takes on the mask of an eagle. And we can go to the Gorm's cave, which you can see in my videos as well. That's where the man that takes on the beak of a kite. We have another man that takes on the persona of an ostrich. Okay. And why would someone take on the persona of an ostrich to travel the great beyond is not what this ostrich's purpose was. It was to run fast like an ostrich. So one can take on many traits or strengths of the animals of using birds that are not specifically to travel to the great beyond. So this concept of the bird man that we have in Abrahamic traditions, we have it in China, we have it through the Buddhist world, we have the Hindus, we have this just about everywhere you can go, we have this bird man. And it asks the question, okay, I'll go with, we had diffusion 22,000 years or so through Beringia and 15,000 years or so down into North and South America. It still doesn't explain why we have this psychological tradition of traveling to the great beyond through the bird itself. We have the same tradition of cosmic mountains or sacred mountains around the world. I live in Oregon here, and we have Klamath Mountain was, you know, spoke to the great mystery. We have two mountains, Mount Adams and Mount Hood, which fought each other over a woman, of course, which became Mount St. Helens. Mount Everest was believed to be an abode of a female goddess. And of course, we can look at Mount Olympus. We can look at Atlas in North Africa. Everywhere you go, you can find the so-called cosmic mountain. And we can again say that's diffusion from 23,000 years, you know, through Beringia down into North America and into other continents as well, because we have this in Australia, we have it in Indonesia as a spiritual place. The question, though, becomes, why do we do this? Why did we retain something? I can understand retaining the constellation Ursa Major and Sirius, but why would we retain a cosmic mountain? Why would we retain these traditions of the Birdman? Is there something within us that sort of calls us to do this? And that takes us to the realm of Carl Jung and Jungian psychology. Carl Jung found that the two most common non-organic characters in dreams were the water of transformation, lake or river, or a mountain. Okay. So why do we have these in our dreams? Is it because we keep seeing them in the archaeology? Is it because we've seen that our art that goes back for tens of thousands of years? Is it because we have in our mythology that we keep retelling ourselves? I don't think that's enough, because we can drive down the highway and you might get out of the car, and you've probably done this, to have your picture taken against a tall mountain. You've probably, you know, in years past or not too far long ago, you probably climbed mountains for no apparent reason except to go to the top. So it really asks us from a psychological perspective, why do we do this? And of course, this is beyond the realm of archaeology. And this is beyond the realm of anthropology, because this falls into that heap that the Russian ethnographers found among the shamanistic people in Siberia of, we don't really understand this. We don't know what to do with this. So we just put it in the heap. And of course, that heap became Mircea Eladi's works and people's since then as well. But it truly asks us a psychological question is, why do we believe these things? First, I can tell you 34,000 years ago, it's animism. Okay. So we believe that we can take on the strength of these animals with the bird or the horse and so on to gain their strength to help us to the great beyond. And you can find the same traditions in shamanic cultures in Siberia where there's a dance with the horse and you become a bird and to travel to the world of the dead or the other realm. But why do we retain this as modern citizens of this world? It's a big question. And I'm going to pose that question to you, Alan, as a purveyor of many realms. Why do we do that?
I think part of it is based in sort of the software of our minds. I call it neurotheology is part of it, and neurophysiology. And I know that at least some of that is explored in this upcoming book that I've written with Tirtha, regarding some of the ways that we perceive the universe and how we sort of grok the world. But some of it just relates to the way our minds and our physiology are built and sort of the nature of who we are. And as you put it, the archetypes and the elemental nature of sort of viewing the natural world and doing what I call it the habits and habitats of the natural world, and how that influences the way we think and believe and create the sacred narratives that surround us. Am I at all on anything?
Well, I think you are. And I think you give a value perspective from your history as an individual. And we all bring our history as individuals into the table. And through some coalescence and contributions, you know, mass contributions, we may come to some sort of a, it's not answer. The answer is not going to be scientific. It's not going to be measurable. That place
yeah,
that I
it's
came
not
from
be
before,
Ryan, exactly,
started
yeah.
before Orion.
No.
This is not measurable. And so how do we approach this from a scientific, well, you know, psychology itself, one could actually argue that it's, you know, I'm right. very pro-psychologist, okay? But one could argue a lot about psychology. It's hocus pocus, it's mumbo jumbo, and it's voodoo. But it helps people. That's the important thing. It helps people. So shamans in Siberia, they all the things that they do is not for their own benefit, but it's to help someone with an individual illness. It's to help the success of the clan. It helps people. And that kind of, you know, how does that mix into the world of medicine? And, you know, it really opens up, you know, Pandora's box for what is not measurable, but works. Therefore, a lot of the stuff is psychological. And the only thing that I can, you know, in my much less than infinite wisdom is that, you know, I can keep going back to animism, that we draw on the strength of the animals. You know, if you look in the, go to the theater, you know, maybe not today, go to the theater, but, you know, 2 years ago, you saw Aquaman uh-huh. takes on the strength of a fish. You see Batman maybe 2 years earlier. You saw Spider-Man. So in our modern world, we don't create new myths about in the ways that the ancient Egyptians did, you know, in text form that we stories that we tell, but yeah. we actually project them onto yeah. the big screen that we take yes. on the strength of those animals. And so, of course, the Birdman becomes in that same realm, but still asks the question, you know, why do we do that? And then why do we, is there something wired in our brain that allows us to believe this crazy idea of a Spider-Man, of an Aquaman, and a Batman? Because there's, as far as we know, there is no other being on this planet that has that ability. And of course, that's what sets us aside to become, you know, Homo Paranoia. Some people have described us as Homo Sapiens, the wise man, but we are really Homo Paranoia, who finds things in our minds. We find pictures in the rocks, and then we tell stories about them. We make up things in our head that is, it becomes, you know, this brilliant culture that we are as Homo Paranoia. So here's a question for you, Alan. Is, you know, you've taken this journey, you've read some of my work before, you've watched some of the videos, and we've walked down a road that very much intersects Absolutely. With your guests a few weeks ago, yeah. Perhaps the last guest you had on the program. And he was absolutely brilliant because he took the road of animism as the core. How does this intersect with your mm-hmm. fundamental belief systems? You know, I'm going to tell you right now, when I first started writing this stuff, I had friends that just like completely shut me down. Uh-huh. They said, this can't be true. This is not what we believe. This defies science
well,
and reason.
I know that.
You know, someone might have some religious bent and like, yeah. you know,
well,
this is
being
you know,
somebody
heretical.
You know, sort of my life has sort of been a roadmap to comparative theology or comparative religion. And I enjoy the work that I do as an archaeologist, anthropologist, and study rock art all over the world, as you do, and experience it in a deep dive. And what I see there is the unity of sort of the consciousness of people or of mankind, humankind, and the same patterns, the same things you've talked about appear on the rocks that appear as well in the major religions. So we talk about sacrifice, we talk about renewal and the death and life, the sun, the moon, the stars, and transformation, resurrection. And this journey is always portrayed on the rocks through pictures. And also there's a continuous expression for supplication and prayer and veneration and all of that other ethereal concepts are there. And I believe that this reinforces sort of the value and understanding of sort of we have a hole in our soul a tremendous need for a divinity, a higher power, a sort of a theological connection to the universe. Am I on it or no?
Well, that is a personal belief system based on what you bring to the conversation. And I can't say that it's right, and I certainly can't say that it's wrong, but there is this truly immeasurable question.
No, and I absolutely agree.
So Moses goes to the mountain to hear, you know, to receive the Ten Commandments from the Great Almighty. Well, he went to the mountain. And we can go throughout the Old and New Testaments, and we can find a lot of mountains that a lot of people climbed. They died, they were transformed on, all these sort of things, but they kept going to the mountain. We can go around the world to religions and find the hero or the spiritual character climbs the mountain. This cosmic mountain, this mountain of faith. And you know, there's a song from my time when I was in high school, was Billy Joel, and it was the River of Dreams. And the story behind that was Billy Joel is he wakes up, he's in his dreams, this story comes to his head. And he's not a spiritual man, and I think he wrote a song somewhere, I'm not a spiritual man. And he goes into the shower, he tries to wash it off, he still can't get it off. And he says, you know, this song is calling me, I don't know what to do with it. So he writes it down, walks away from it. It turns out to be one of his biggest songs like ever. And the song is about Billy Joel. He took some mountains of faith and crossing the river. And the river's too deep to cross, because what he's saying is, I'm not ready to go to the other side because I lack that spirituality to do it, and I'll drown in the middle. And so that Billy Joel never actually, apparently was never exposed to a psychologist who would have said, you know, Billy, these are archetypal themes, and they're telling you about your struggle with spirituality and these themes that are in your head. And through another party, I would say, I'm not going to say who, but knows that Billy Joel used to actually hang out in the Abbey. Okay. And he used to drink with the monks, and he used to talk about these things with the monks. But Billy Joel, he had it in his dream, the same dreams that we have. And how do we deal with that in our modern time? And that's probably a good ending for this program and a transition to the next.
Bernie, I have to say that this has been an astounding experience and remarkable. And what a blessing it was to have you here to share your insights and wisdom. So we had the deepest dive I think we've ever had on a program and gone across at least 40,000 years worth of prehistory in a matter of an hour. God bless you, and congratulations for your ability to sort of weave that story. Greatly appreciated.
That was great. Thank you very much, Alan.
Thanks for joining us for Rock Art Podcast 53. See you on the flip-flop. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.